You've heard about Occupy Wall Street. What about Occupy Your Body?
Woohoo! This is a good one. Not the easiest tree to climb, but probably one of the most fun trees I've ever climbed. Hi. Let me catch my breath for a moment. It's easy to be disembodied in the computer age, in an era in which we are conditioned and encouraged to be productive, and where our productivity doesn't always require us to use our bodies at all. But that's not the main thing that keeps us in our heads instead of in our bodies. One of the most important reasons we make this separation is that we've all learned to think of ourselves as bodies seen from the outside. We have ideas about what our bodies are like and should be like that keep us from an actual embodied experience of what it's like to feel yourself from the inside. I mean, imagine if you and everyone you know felt basically okay about our bodies. I might like to play dress up from time to time, but I don't need that to be able to tell that I'm lovable and that I'm okay. If we all felt that way, industries would fall. There's the beautification industry and the fashion industry and the dieting industry, and they all require us to put a lot of money into things that help us feel better about ourselves because our default baseline is that we don't think we're okay the way that we are. This is all kind of a part of this movement that you've probably heard of, the Occupy movement. It's about taking back for the people, for 99% of us, what corporations have kind of taken over in ways that don't serve everybody. The same thing has happened to our bodies. We have learned to think that there's something wrong with us because that benefits corporations and industries that feed off of our feeling bad about ourselves.
This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is sexploration.
Explore. Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica.
Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica at sexplorationwithmonica.com.
So we are now camped out next to the waterfall. This is the Prayer Cross in Golden Gate Park. And Steve Behrman and I have hiked here, listening to all the sounds of Golden Gate Park and trying to be, where should we do our interview? Oh, near the ducks or near the snowy egret? Or there's a little lake here, and we decided the waterfall made the most consistent noises for your outdoor experience of audio. We're going to talk about his work with a lot of different things. He does some work with relationships, and he has this great video called Occupy Your Body, which is about how sometimes we get so up in our minds that we're not even aware of what's going on with our body, and we start to develop kind of this love-hate relationship with our body, like, why aren't you more attractive, or, you know, whatever, all the things that we have about our body. And then with relationships and jealousy, he has a class called Ending Jealousy. So I'd like to introduce you again to Steve Behrman of the Interchange Counseling Institute. Welcome to Sexploration with Monica.
Thanks, Monica. I'm so happy you're interviewing me.
Yeah, so we had a conversation at Sex at Dawn. Didn't we have a little...
Yeah, we talked briefly about ending jealousy permanently and what happens in that workshop and the whole ending jealousy concept.
Mm-hmm. Do you talk about like polyamory or non-monogamy, open relationships?
Well, I actually, as much as I can when I teach that workshop, I don't talk about those things.
Right.
I attract a lot of people who are in open relationships and who are polyamorous, but the work is just as relevant for people who are monogamous.
Oh, yeah.
It turns out that jealousy is just as much of a factor in monogamous relationships as in non-monogamous relationships, so I try to make it as kind of universally relevant as possible.
So you have a couple of things, different classes that you teach around relationships. I definitely want to talk about ending jealousy. But first, let's talk about Occupy Your Body, because I really enjoyed that video where you climb a tree, you come down, you've just climbed a tree, and then you go back up the tree after talking about all these great things. So you talk about how people are starting to get really divorced with their bodies in our modern, postmodern world.
Yeah, because we have learned, for one, to be in our heads in general, especially if you're not in a trade where you work with your hands for a living, most of us learn that our productivity comes from using our minds. But the real problem is that we have learned to have ideas about how everything should be, and certainly about how our bodies should be. So our relationship, our primary relationship with our bodies, tends to be ideas about how we think our bodies should be, as opposed to having an experience of what our bodies are like from the inside, what our bodies want and need, and what it feels like to be us.
Right. So like when we're eating food, we think about like what it tastes like in the moment, but then we don't really tap into how our bodies feel later.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a sort of even more general example. If you ask somebody, what kind of body do you have? The way people describe their bodies will tend to be about what their bodies look like. Sometimes they'll use a descriptor like, you know, athletic, or they'll say the kinds of things that people say in personals ads. And that's the closest someone will come to actually describing how their body might actually function. Someone doesn't say, oh, I have a very grounded body. I'm really grounded. I have a way of just being kind of fully situated wherever I am. Or they don't say, I'm really springy. I just have all this kind of energy and I just bounce kind of wherever I go.
Right.
People instead describe what their bodies look like from the outside, because we have learned to see our bodies as objects, not experience them from the inside as subjects. And in doing so, we've learned to compare our bodies with external standards of what we think bodies are supposed to be like. And we are constantly evaluating and wondering whether each of our individual body parts is the right size, shape, color, and texture, and whether it's as good as somebody else's, real or imagined.
So why is it important to experience your body from the inside? Like, why does it matter? How does it affect us that we're constantly experiencing our bodies from the outside as an object and comparing them to other bodies?
Well, the difference it makes is that you can never really know what your body needs in order for you to be fully alive, fully energized, clear of mind, to feel healthy, and in fact to have your health and well-being be sustainable over time. You can never know what your body needs for those things to happen unless you can sense it. You won't ever get those things, even if you have an idea about what it is that your diet should be, because you've read a book or you subscribe to some philosophy about nutrition.
It's the paleo diet.
Right, or any diet, right? It's just an idea. I mean, the paleo diet and any diet has some great merits, but it's useful for some kinds of people at some times in their lives and not for other people at other times. And there are so many ideas about what you should eat and shouldn't eat and when and how that you, first of all, can't follow them all. But any of them are just ideas until you put them into practice and, like you said, sense from the inside what the result is. Not just what it's like to be eating something that you like the smell or the taste of, but after you're done eating it, how do you feel? And if you eat that kind of diet for several days on end, does it change something about how you feel? Does it change something about your energy level or what you notice yourself wanting to do or not do, or even the ways in which you're thinking? Do you have enough of a relationship with your body that you can sense that? Now, the occupy your body concept is that in order for us to get from being in our heads about our bodies to actually being embodied, you have to go through a few steps. And so the first is that you have this notion about what you should eat, for instance. And then if you want to find out what your body really wants, have to go through a kind of exploratory phase. You have to try eating different ways and find out what works and what doesn't. But it can be difficult to know what works and what doesn't, because what people tend to experience more than anything else is if you start to change the way that you eat or the way that you exercise or the way that you relate to other bodies with your body, people have to go through a phase of feeling uncomfortable. There is usually some discomfort involved. So if I start eating in a way that may ultimately be better for me or more healthy, I may no longer be using food to stuff really aversive and uncomfortable feelings, and maybe I have to feel those feelings now that I didn't have to feel before. I have to be willing to go through that phase to then find out about, is this something that ultimately will really feed me? But it starts off feeling like anything different is wrong, because it feels uncomfortable.
because we have certain habits that we use to actually, I mean, some people use food as kind of a self-medicating thing, like really heavy things like cheeses or, you know, wine or sugar. All of those things can be kind of like a self-medication to maybe help you deal with feelings, or maybe you don't have other kinds of pleasure in your life, so you're constantly seeking pleasure through, you know, really sugary things, and you don't really have a balanced diet. Do you mean stuff like that?
Yeah, that's one level of it for sure, is that we use food for purposes other than nutrition. We use it to make ourselves feel better or to keep from having to feel bad. And so if you're no longer using food for those purposes, well, then you've got some feelings that you have to deal with that you may not have any other way to deal with. Food is the way you've always dealt with them, and you have to go through that process. But there's another thing that happens. You know, there's this very popular kind of concept of detoxing.
Yeah, totally. Like if you just only have lemon juice, cayenne pepper, and maple syrup, all of your problems will be over.
Yeah, so clearly it's a somewhat problematic concept, but the notion is that when you start to eat in a way that's cleaner, that you free up systems of your body that have been kind of, you know, full of the gunk that you've been feeding them, so that stuff starts to release and you feel bad for a while and you might get sick, and that's part of the process of clearing yourself out so that eventually you can feel better. And it's different if you think about something like taking on a new form of exercise. Like, I don't know if you're a runner, but...
I tried it. It's really hard. I respect runners.
Yeah, it's really hard. And it was something that I never used to do and discovered it a couple of years ago. But my initial experience of running was that it was terrible. Why would anybody ever do this to themselves? It felt awful. And partly it felt awful because I just was so out of shape. I got out of breath so easily. That was uncomfortable. I felt just too kind of fat and clunky and creaky. And so I had to go through that a few times to get to the point where I finally had the experience that everybody always talks about, where you feel really amazing after you've been running for a while. And then I found that running really fed me. It actually is something that my body wanted to do more of. I mean, it's not something that I do a lot of. There are other things I tend to prefer in terms of how I use my body. But I had to go through this phase to discover what running had for me, what was in it, and how it actually made me more alive, which was a goal.
Well, even something like climbing, which is a great exercise, and many people really enjoy also because it's fun. I mean, running is great because, you know, there's that runner's high and everything else, but climbing can make you sore at the beginning as well. Like, you have to build up calluses. There's, like, little muscles in your arms that you didn't know that you had. You know, it's kind of this whole experience of like, oh, ah, you know?
Yeah, obviously you've done it enough to know something about that. And it's always like that. It's always like that when you're trying out something new that you have to kind of find your way into. You have to be able to get through that phase to then find out, well, is this really something that gives your body more of what your body wants? So that you can go from this idea about exercise and how often you should exercise and what kind of exercise you should do to actually sensing what your body likes. What does your particular body like to do? Because if you do the thing your body likes to do, eventually, after you get through that discomfort phase, then it no longer is a chore. You're not exercising just as a matter of discipline, because I know a lot of people out there have this relationship with discipline where they think, does that even exist? Is that a myth? Because they have no personal experience of it. Well, it turns out it's not so necessary. If you're doing something that you really like doing, you just want to do that more, it doesn't require you to get yourself to do it. It's finding out what that is. It's going through the process necessary to find out what that is. That's about really starting to inhabit your body.
Like making belly dancing or like a yoga class that you really enjoy, like part of your exercise routine. So it's not like what I loved what you said in Occupy Your Body was about how exercise is this horrible word for people. It's like diet and exercise. Oh, that's no fun. But like if you do something that your body really enjoys and you sense that then it can really create a different relationship to movement and to experiencing.
Yeah, I love doing almost anything in nature. And so I get out in nature and then I want to see what's around the next corner. And so it just moves me forward. It just motivates me to go places I couldn't go otherwise. Whereas I never go to the gym and I just can't understand people who do. But I know people who love the gym. It's the thing that they crave. They can't wait to get some time to go to the gym again. It seems crazy to me, but it's what they like. It's what their bodies enjoy doing.
So in Healing Body Shame, you talk about, and this kind of has to do with some of the things that you talked about in Occupy Your Body, experiencing your body from the inside and not so much treating your own body as if it were an object to carry your brain around, you know, like really experiencing your body. And that would actually go a long way to enriching your sex life, because instead of, you know, approaching sex as something that you're doing, it's something that you would be feeling. And the more you can have awareness around what you're feeling, the more your arousal will grow, the more your awareness of what you're feeling will grow. So your arousal will grow exponentially. I mean, people can get into erotic trances just from the awareness of these kinds of sensations. So how can we kind of get into our bodies and stop making our bodies into objects? Like, how do you start to heal that sort of rift between, like, experiencing yourself as an object and being actually inside your body and appreciating and loving your body?
That's a great question.
I know, it's
that's the crux of the matter. And, you know, I'll say first that when it comes to something like sex, it's no different than exercise or diet. We're just loaded down with ideas about how we're supposed to be as sexual beings and what we're supposed to want and not supposed to want. So many of us grew up with such massive inhibitions around sex, and we definitely live in a society that's caught somewhere between inhibition and obsession, because we don't learn to find out for ourselves who we are as sexual beings, what we actually want. And like you're saying, when you can tune into what your body really wants, that's the whole point. That's where arousal comes from. That's when it's possible to enter into these much deeper states of communion and ecstasy through sexuality. You never get there if you're doing what you think you're supposed to do as a sexual being. So when it comes to sex, as it does in these other areas of using your body, you've got to be able to overcome your notions about what your body should be like. And the most basic way in which this happens, sort of this brings us back to the beginning of our conversation, has to do with how we learn to see our bodies from the outside and what we think they're supposed to look like. And I have almost never met anybody whose relationship with their body is, I have always thought my body was just right the way it is. I have always loved my body unconditionally the way it already is, without needing to do anything different to feel okay about myself. Instead, people like certain parts and not other parts, or maybe they don't like themselves at all. They've learned to think that they fail in some competition around what their body should be like. And that is really pure conditioning. That's something that we learn to do. And one of the reasons we learn to do it, and the reason why I chose the phrase occupy your body to talk about this concept, is because it greatly benefits a number of corporations and industries for us to feel bad about ourselves. It means that we put a lot of time and energy and, of course, money into trying to make our bodies and our looks different, because we think that will make us feel better about who we are. And so we've been deeply conditioned to think we're not already okay. And no matter how much we change, there's always this lingering sense, I'm not already okay the way that I am. And so there is some antidote to that, and it has to do with learning to unconditionally love your body. And this unconditional notion is a little bit hard for people to grasp. It means you would love your body no matter what, right? There are no conditions in which you wouldn't. And in fact, there are no conditions in which you wouldn't consider your body to be beautiful. Because that is part of what it means to unconditionally love your body. You find yourself beautiful as you already are. You find what you've got now to be the thing that is of beauty. Your beautiful wrinkles, or your beautiful cellulite, or the shape and the quality of skin that you happen to have already, right, are actually beautiful. And if you can't see that they're beautiful, that's because you've been so deeply conditioned. You've been taught to feel bad about being the way that you are, because that feeling bad, that shame, actually benefits somebody else somewhere.
What if you do, in fact, have, I mean, and not something superficial like stretch mark cellulite or, you know, fat, But like, what if you have like a serious health condition that makes you have some kind of you're breaking out in some way, or you have hives, or you have like serious acne. I mean, sometimes people really feel that they have real reasons to dislike their body, like they have, you know, maybe a disability, or they have some disease, or do you know what I mean? And it's not, I mean, how do you kind of wrestle with that? Like thinking that you're okay and loving who you are and how you are, even when you're not completely healed. Do you know what I mean? Even though you do have real problems.
Yeah. So let me take those are some great examples. Let me take the being in a wheelchair kind of example. So if you have a real disability, meaning if you have real limitations on what you can do, you're suggesting that that might be kind of a legitimate reason to dislike your body. And certainly it can be it can be really hard, and especially for people who had a level of functionality that they have since lost, there can be this real process of grieving that has to happen to accept the new limitations. But we all have limitations. You know, it's funny, it's like most people don't go around lamenting the fact that they're tied by gravity to the ground and unable to fly, right? But it's a limitation that we all possess. We all have all kinds of physical limitations that we think are okay, because we're not comparing ourselves to other people who can do things that we can't do, and we're not comparing ourselves to the difference between what we can do now and what we used to be able to do in the past. And so there's some wisdom in that we all have our limitations, and the goal is to be able to love and accept yourself as you are with what you are capable of, and to become more and more capable in the ways that you wish to be that are possible for you. So on one level, we're talking about actual limits to our ability to function in our bodies because of pain that we're in, or because of parts of our bodies that don't work. And so you can still love your body completely and unconditionally for what it is and for what it's not, even when that's the case. Now, when you're talking about something like if you're breaking out, if you have really severe acne or hives, and certainly people do, part of the issue is that you're not being seen as beautiful unconditionally by the world around you. It's not like, when I say we've been conditioned, I don't mean to suggest that our conditioning happened in the past. It's happening every day. We are every day surrounded by images of how we're supposed to be, and we're given positive and negative reinforcement for changes that we make in how we are. So you are having to contend with the way that you're seen in the world, which makes it an even greater challenge to come to love yourself regardless of how anybody else sees you. Your beauty is not dependent on the smoothness of your skin. And unfortunately, we've learned to believe that it is. Your beauty comes from somewhere else. And I don't mean to say that everybody's just always completely beautiful. I think you can become more and more beautiful. And the way that you do that is by becoming more internally undivided. If you feel like, if you're not fighting against yourself, if you and the way you actually are right now are in alignment, if your sense of how you should be and the way you actually are in alignment, you're in some ways at peace in yourself. You can be your more complete and full self because you love yourself, and that shows through in your physical appearance. There's some way it shines through out your eyes and your facial expressions. There's a kind of beauty that comes from that. That to me is real beauty. How you look on the outside is something that will determine a lot about how you're treated in society. So I don't mean to discount that.
I actually read a study where what you can do to make yourself 5 times more attractive instantly is just smile and make eye contact. And so I think that some of the ways that we become less attractive when we're so worried that we're not attractive is that we're not really paying attention to the person who's next to us. We don't really believe in ourselves. You know what I mean? We're not able to make eye contact. We don't feel or believe that we're sexy, so we don't get turned on or smile. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, thanks. You just said that so much better than I did. It's exactly what we're talking about. There's a way that if you're okay with yourself, you just feel better. You're more present and you're more connected to people, and that is attractive. it allows you to stop being so concerned about yourself and more focused on the other person, and allows you to focus on loving them well. And if you love other people, then they really feel
that.
They love that. And that's one of, that's definitely something that makes people attractive and beautiful, right? There's real beauty in love that's uninhibited and that's fully expressed. And so if you feel too bad about yourself, if there's too much shame for you to do that, then people won't see you as much. You'll either be more invisible, or people will just see your appearance. They'll see the surface. They won't see what inside you is shining through that surface.
I often think about what we really have in this world. We have our attention, and if our attention is so consumed by our thoughts, our fears, our anxieties, rather than on our sensations and on what's happening around us, that there's so much we lose about being alive and experiencing. Because right now we're in a physical body and we're alive and we have the person across from us and we have the ability to experience life. And like, if we miss that part and instead experience what we're supposed to be in some sort of consumerist idea about what people are supposed to be like, we can really miss out on this moment, you know, that we're alive and potentially experiencing some kissing or something really good or whatever. You know what I mean? Whatever sensation that you're experiencing right now, from the wind on your skin to, you know, if you're actually having sex, if you're too busy thinking about what you're supposed to look like, you're not going to feel what's actually happening to you. So you're going to miss out on all of the parasympathetic nervous system response that brings you to higher and higher levels of ecstasy.
Or when it comes to sex, if you're too concerned with thinking about whether you're doing it right or not.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, you may be concerned about what you look like, and you also, and this is certainly true for a lot of us men, you may be really concerned about your performance, mm-hmm. and that takes you just as much out of the amazing experience of contact in the moment that you're having as anything else.
Right.
And what you're describing is exactly the reason to love your body unconditionally right now already, because you've got one, and you're able to experience life through it, through whatever senses you have available to you. Mm-hmm. And you're able to make contact with others in whatever form that contact takes, right? So you might be experiencing this wonderful kissing in the moment, and you also might just be experiencing the presence of another and experiencing their experience of your presence. And that's profound if you can really occupy your body, if you're really inhabiting yourself and the moment and aware of the person who's with you. That's like the goal of life right there.
Totally. And it's so funny how oftentimes, you know, even when we're talking about Tantra or BDSM or clinical sexology, all of these different kinds of practices, when we're talking about, and even relationships, it'll all come back to like being present in the moment, being authentic, accepting yourself and the other person and really experiencing what's going on. It's funny how top space and tantric rapture, I guess, or maybe a tantric ecstatic moment, like those are really all the same thing. Let's talk some about your work in relationships. I know that you taught that class, Ending Jealousy Forever, and you also have a class that I think is really interesting on how to lose an argument. How to lose an argument. You're not even saying how to win an argument or how to both people win an argument or whatever. So how do you lose an argument, and why would you want to?
Well, okay, I'm going to give this will not initially sound like a direct answer to your question, but I liked something that you were saying about how it's about being in the present. But for many of us, having a real relational moment and being in the present, that just sounds like a dream. Maybe, I wish maybe someday I could do that. So I've seen people do it, but I have no idea how. And so you have to, in order to be able to, what being present really means is you have to be able to be where you are now. And so if you're in contact with another person and how you are now is that you feel bad about the way you look, or you're self-conscious about it, or you're worried about what they're going to think about you, or you're competing with them, if you can bring those things into consciousness, if you can name them and make them the thing that you're interacting about, then you get more present. If the thing that's happening under the surface already, that's whether you want it to or not, influencing every moment of your interaction, if that becomes the thing that you're now both aware of together because you're talking about it, you're more deeply connected, there's more intimacy, and you're more present. So I just want to say, you don't have to have already achieved enlightenment to have this experience of being present with another. You just have to be real about how you already are in relation to them and what feelings are really there. And that is one of the keys to this question about how do you lose an argument. You have to be aware of what's happening inside of you, and you have to be able to name it. You have to be able to talk about it. It's a really different approach to being in a conversation where you want something, and you think the way that you can get what you want is to convince the other person to feel or think or act differently. It's a really different way to be in that conversation, to tune into what's going on in you and your fears and your desires, as opposed to focusing on the other person and what's wrong with them and how you can better manipulate them into conforming with your view of the world so that you'll get the thing that you think that you need.
But why would you want to lose an argument? And why would you want to not make them be different? Because, I mean, ostensibly, you're mad at them. They're doing it wrong, and you want them to be different. So now you have to convince them why they're doing it wrong by telling them all the horrible things that they did last week. Why did you do that, right?
And that works so well. We've all tried it, and we find that it's incredibly effective in getting us what we want. Right? No, it never works. I mean, the whole point is that if anybody wins an argument, everybody loses. And by the time it's easy to lose an argument, actually. All you have to do is have one. And already everybody's lost because you're out of collaboration, you're in competition, you're out of connection, and you're in some kind of delusion about what it is that you think the other person should do or be or think or feel that's different from what they are.
Like you're angry, maybe you're triggered or something, and you just feel like you're doing it wrong. And a lot of times, you know, when you're emotionally triggered, when you're angry, I mean, that can be part of the whole thing of, like, it's really hard to even see the other person or be with the other person. You know what I mean?
Yes. And what can facilitate you being able to be with the other person is if you can, in a really honest way, report on your own experience by saying, oh, my God, I feel so angry right now. There is a world of difference between saying, I feel so angry right now, and saying, you stupid idiot, which is just an expression of the anger. So if I'm now self-aware and I'm bringing that self-awareness into the conversation can go somewhere completely different. Now, I really feel the great need to fess up in the middle of this conversation and say that I really hope by the time this workshop, How to Lose an Argument, comes around, that I actually know something more about it than I do now.
Well,
so that I can
hard.
Teach it. It's
yeah.
One of these workshops that I, you know, came up with because I thought, oh, I'd really like to learn this. And if I'm going to teach about it between now and when I teach about it, I've really got to get it. But I find this just as challenging as everybody else does. I know that the goal is to transcend this whole paradigm of right and wrong and blame and responsibility, to get into a paradigm where we're both just talking about the differences between how we understand the world and how we wish the world to be. Because I'm arguing with you because there's some way that I wish the world to be, and it's different from how it is now, or it's different from how I perceive it to be now. And I think you're the key to getting it the way I want it to be. And if I could even just expose all that to you, you know, if I could say, like, gosh, you know, I really just want to be so, like, my fantasy is that I would live in a house where the person who I lived with just was, like, totally cool about my making a mess all the time. Like, you just felt like it was just I wish that you just were delighted by it. Like, oh my God, it's so great how free and easy you are. And
right.
You're so relaxed. You don't need to clean everything up all the time. And I know that's not how you see it, but I just have this wish that, like, I could be okay because I feel so bad about how disorganized I am. Right now I'm talking to you, first of all, about my wish about how I wish the world could be, and how I know that it's kind of a maybe ridiculous or impossible wish, but we could then collaborate on that. You know, you could tell me what your wish is about how you want reality to be. And I could say, okay, I want it to try to be, let's make it my job to see to it that you get a house that is run by the value system of order and organization. And then your job is to see to it that I get to live in a house that's run by the value system of kind of ease and freedom. Now, I can say to you, okay, well, I'll just clean up. I will just always now clean up the dishes as soon as I use them. After every meal, I'll wash the dishes. And you, well, then your job would be to say to me, no, you can't do that. Then where's the freedom and ease that you're after? Right? So if it becomes your job to make sure there's enough freedom and ease and my job to ensure there's enough order and organization, well, then we're in a different kind of interaction with each other. Right? Nobody's trying to win. There's not a competition. Instead, we've got this really actually complex problem, which is how do we both get the thing that we're after, even though those things, at least in the moment, seem to be different from one another?
And there's also this interesting way of how you're not really accepting things as they are when you're going into a space of, you know, disagreement and argument. And it also, if we could just really accept the other person as they are, and then really talk about, like, okay, I think, I feel, you know, those kinds of statements that aren't like, you are so messy.
Even though you are.
And, like, how do you, you know, how does, you know, how do you balance that with, you know, I do feel like I need a certain amount of order and, you know, this is what I want and this is my preference. But, you know, how do you do that from a place of acceptance and love? And then also not making the other person wrong. You know what I mean? Even though your mother would be shocked.
Well, I mean, you only make the reason for making the other person wrong is that, well, there's, I would say, two reasons for it. On your end, it makes you right. So it helps you defend your position, which you could otherwise lose. I mean, a lot of us have a hard time holding on to what we believe to be true or need or want for ourselves. So it makes you stronger in your ability to hold on to what it is that you want to need. And then it has this other wonderful added benefit of making the other person feel bad about themselves. Right, here we are now back to the land of shame and guilt.
Right,
we've all been conditioned with this stuff. How do we get here? Yeah, we got here because we started off here. We were all born into this. You know, whatever religion you grew up with, whatever cultural community you were in has some variation on how to guilt people into acting the ways people are supposed to act. And so we just make use of that when we're in arguments with people. I am going to figure out exactly the ways I can best make you feel bad about yourself because I think that will get you to change in the ways that I wish you could change so the world can be the way I want the world to be. And of course, it just doesn't work. I mean, that's why it's much better off. We're all much better off if we lose. As soon as you win that, you know, then what you've done is made the other person feel bad about themselves. And that does not contribute to the aliveness in relationships.
So how do you foster that collaboration? You know, the we're on the same team, we're working together. I mean, that's how you get people to actually do what you want them to do is, in, you know, you make it a collaboration. Like, they already want to do it.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're in the relationship for. And I would presume that most people are in relationships because they enjoy the added benefits of all the things that we get from being in contact and in cooperation with each other. And you lose out on all of that if you are in an argument. I mean, everyone hates arguments, especially if you're in one of those arguments that just goes on and on, and the whole time you're kicking yourself and you're saying, oh, I know I shouldn't be saying the things that are coming out of my mouth. I just can't stop myself.
And the recycling of old garbage.
Oh, yeah, it's just is never new. It's always the same. It's completely unpleasant for everyone.
You always do this. Oh.
And so, you know, what we're talking about is a better alternative. It's an alternative in which we can all just fess up to the fact that we're scared that we're not going to get what we need, that we feel bad about wanting the things that we want, that we don't know how to do the things that the other person wants us to do. I mean, I could say, I really wish I could be cleaner. I just have no idea how to do that. I'm just going to fail. I could agree to do it again and I'll fail again and then I'll feel even worse about myself because I feel terrible now. So, okay, like, if things are going to get cleaner around here, somehow I have to learn how to do that. I don't know how to do that. And that feels so shameful to me. Now we're in a conversation that's collaborative. I want to be able to give you what you want, and I just don't know how. We're all in this position where we feel incompetent and incapable, and we're afraid we won't get our needs met, and we feel bad about wanting what we want. And if we can just kind of get there together, there's the possibility of looking at what's... Can we really support each other to get our real needs met? Can we help each other feel better? Can we help each other learn capacities that we don't now have that will allow us to function better together?
That's one of the things that I just love about relationships, because they're so challenging. They are our best mirrors. They're our best avenues for personal or for spiritual growth, depending on what you believe in. Because relationships, we have to be our true and most vulnerable selves. Like, people get to know who we really are in our most intimate relationships. So I just think about, you know, how important they are to ourselves and our lives, and how we can really serve each other at different periods in our life by being in relationships with each other. But we do have this idea that relationships, especially sexual relationships, are supposed to last forever. You know, that we're supposed to have this one person, and that person is going to be able to meet all of our needs forever. And that person is probably going to have to be a heterosexual relationship as well. Because if we're trying to meet all the standards of our culture, you know, that's what we've been conditioned, or that's what we've been, you know, told we're supposed to do. But is that really going to work for us all of the time?
Right.
Trick question, sorry.
Well, I mean, you've got a lot of great stuff packed into that question, including the idea that it's one person that meets all our needs,
right.
The idea that relationships must last forever or they're clearly failures, and just a kind of worldview that's about our goal is to set up a life in which you find the one person for yourself. And all of those are really problematic. And the one person notion is super problematic, even for people who are monogamous and who have tried being non-monogamous, explored the issue, and decided that monogamy is, that's just the way for them. Still, one person is never going to be enough. You may only have a sexual relationship with one person, but it's essential for everybody to have multiple intimate relationships where they get real needs met. And all of those relationships will evolve and change and grow over time. And in particular, relationships that are romantic or sexual may have a lifespan. They may have a natural life cycle. And at some point, it may be appropriate for them to stop being a primary relationship or a sexual relationship. And that's natural. It's just part of how it seems to go when we're not being hard on ourselves and blaming ourselves for relationships not lasting forever.
Right. Well, people change, you know, and our needs change and our lives change and what we want changes. And even really superficial details like where we want to live and the kinds of work that we want to do will change what works for us in terms of domestic partnerships and sexual partnerships. So it's interesting. I think one of your next classes that is about relationships is called The Power of Goodbye. And instead of, I think one of the most popular songs on the radio right now, it's by Gautier, and it's like somebody that I used to know, you know, where this person, they had a, you know, an intimate relationship, sex partners, domestic partnerships, and they broke up, and it's like, now I don't even know you, we're not going to still be friends, you had your friends come pick up your stuff, and you changed your number, and so now that you're just somebody that, and they're actually like kind of screaming at each other in the choruses, you know, you can really hear the pain in their voices. And it's just so interesting to think about, like, okay, how could we break up better in this culture?
Right, because otherwise it feels so rough.
Oh, it's the worst.
Yeah.
I used to love you, and now I hate you. Oh, God.
So it's amazing the amount of energy that we put into beginning relationships. We just, you know, there are just dating websites and whole kind of dating rituals and... People make lists of what they're looking for, and they put a lot of consciousness into it, a lot of energy into making sure a relationship starts well. And almost none of that goes into seeing to it that relationships end well. And we need to, in order to move on from relationships cleanly and to learn as much from them as we can so that the next relationship you move into, you do even better than the previous one. In order to do that, you've got to put some conscious awareness into how you end a relationship. Now, part of the phenomena that you're talking about has to do with the ways people get themselves to break out of the inertia of their relationship. Often, I love you so much, or I'm getting some really important needs met in our relationship, so much so that I will put up with things that I shouldn't, and I'll do things that I ought not be doing. In order to break out of that, I may need to demonize you and blame you and make it seem as if I never loved you or you never loved me, to do something that will cause a potentially permanent rift between us, but it allows us to get out of the relationship. If instead you can, usually with help, go through a process where you look at where the relationship's been, you know, maybe look at the whole story of how things started and what the middle of the relationship was and how it came to the ending that it's seeming to have, so that you can then look at, well, we're ending and we've got a bunch of stuff that's kind of hanging out unresolved from the past that we feel bad about. Can we spend some time trying to resolve those things together so that we can learn from our past, complete the process, and essentially be able to say, thank you for everything that you've given me. I love you, and I'm sorry that it didn't work out for us. But to do that, you have to go through some initial stages. You have to be able to express your resentments toward one another. You've got to be able to apologize for all the stuff that the other person resents you for. You've got to be able to forgive them for all the things they're apologizing for. Those are the harder parts of cleaning up the past that then allow you to recognize all the things that you got from the relationship and express gratitude, and then to be able to appreciate what you're going to miss and what you loved about being in a relationship. That's all really necessary to be able to fully say goodbye to somebody and grieve and then be complete and move on.
Yeah, I think it's funny how we think, I'm sorry that it didn't work out. Like, we really do have this belief that relationships are supposed to last forever. And, you know, they can last forever as long as we're really fluid and flexible with where we are now and what we want. And we're both really honest about what we want and where we are, and, you know, still making a commitment to meet each other's needs. Like, I really think that people need to get married over and over and over again, because it's not something that just happens one time and then it sticks. You have to keep saying yes to this person again and again in almost every moment.
Right. What you're talking about is that we have this notion that as soon as you make an agreement about your relationship, whether it's marriage or some other...
or monogamy, or just I'm with you,
That idea is enough to make the relationship the relationship. And it's not. The relationship is constantly being renewed. Like, we are in this ongoing, endless process of relating. Like, relationship is something that you do. It's not a thing that you have. It's not an object. It's a process. And so that process is only healthy. It only thrives if, as you're saying, you're constantly choosing each other. If you're constantly responding to the ways the other person is growing and figuring out ways that you can keep growing and changing together instead of trying to maintain some old, stagnant, obsolete way of being that was the way that you were when you got together and it was what allowed the relationship to be meaningful when it started. Right, so those kinds of changes, often, as you're saying, if you're fluid enough, you can have a relationship that keeps growing and changing. But other times you discover that there are just differences in how I grow and how you grow, and it doesn't make sense for us to keep doing the thing that we're doing. And if you have a notion that relationships all have a beginning and a middle and an end, then it's okay that relationships end. I like that you caught me saying, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out.
We always do that.
But that's not really the way to say it, right? The way to say it is, I'm sorry that we're not able to continue, mm-hmm. right? Thank you for everything that we had together. This has been an incredible period of my life. I would not be the person I am without you, and I'm sorry that it's ending, and I love you.
Yeah, like, it's so painful, and oftentimes I just feel like, you know, I'm so grateful that I met you, and I'm so grateful that I learned so much from you. I'll be able to do it better next time completely because I learned so much, you know? But it's hard because, you know, we do really have this sadness about having this off switch on relationships, like we really need to end it. I also think that as our culture gets more comfortable with male-female relationships, and as we start to work on our jealousy issues, I mean, a lot of times what people get jealous over, they're like, oh, you had lunch with your ex, you know? Like, why can't you be friends with these people that you had these amazing experiences and relationships with? It's because we're so easily threatened by other people. But why would you be? I mean, she's still your ex. You know what I mean?
Wait a minute. You're not still in love with her, are you?
I know. How could you still care about her? Does that mean you don't care about me?
Right. I mean, that is clearly the setup. The setup is, if we believe it's only possible to love or care about one person at a time, if we think that it's kind of, if love is like, if it's like a quantity, if it's like money, if it's an economic concept, then there's only so much of it to go around, and you have to be careful where you invest it and make sure you get a good return on your investment and make sure it doesn't get diluted from overuse. And so that's just a crazy notion about how love works. My experience of love is that the more people I'm in love with, the more I just know how to love well. The more love is something that is awake in me and that allows me then to love you more fully. So being in love with my ex, yes, of course, I'm in love with my ex. I feel all these wonderful feelings around them. But it's not just about feelings. I deeply care for this person. I just happen to no longer be in a relationship with them. I'm in a relationship with you. And so that's the difference. But if we're talking about me here, then I need you to be able to embrace my way of loving many people in order for you to accept my love for you, right? This is something that I wish for you too. And I always feel like in these moments, when I start talking about jealousy, when I start talking about loving many people, I always want to give this disclaimer again and say, I'm not talking about polyamory. The things that I'm saying are things that people who are non-monogamous will really relate with, but I am speaking about things that are just as relevant for people who choose to have sexually exclusive relationships. You still, life is better if you can be in love with many people. Different kinds of love, different kinds of relationships, but love of many people makes the love that you have in your monogamous relationship much stronger, much richer.
Right. Like, even if you're just appreciating and loving someone, like catching up with them over lunch, you know, not that you really have to have sex with that person, because even when you're in a monogamous relationship, even if you're not having sex with other people, you can get jealous over things that really have nothing to do with sex.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, jealousy is irrational. I mean, it's kind of cheating to say that because all emotions are irrational. But
I mean, technically, they're sort of rational. I mean, you have a fear of loss. You don't want to be alone. The other person could leave you for this other person. And then you think of, like, all the ways that that person is better than you, prettier than you, smarter than you, has blonder hair, whatever it is.
Right. So you're talking about all the thoughts that go along with the feelings, right? And those thoughts, I mean, some people are thinking more clearly than others, but I understand we're drawing on what at least seems superficially to be rational in coming up with the fears that feed, or the insecurities that feed our jealousies. But what's going on fundamentally is that there's some deep feeling. There's something that's occurring on an emotional level. And being able to pay attention to what's happening on the level of the felt sense in the body, right? This is coming back to being able to occupy your body well enough to know what's going on a body level, on a deep fundamental emotional level. Getting that to move is essential in being able to move through jealousy. But jealousy is something that really grips some people. It's just an overwhelming emotional experience. If we were in the middle of my Ending Jealousy Permanently workshop, I would probably be at the point where I would be saying that jealousy is, in fact, not really a feeling. Jealousy isn't an emotion at all. Jealousy is just this complex experience that consists of a bunch of different feelings that are different for different people. If you stop calling the experience jealousy and you look at what's really going on in the moment, what you find is that there are complex emotions. There's sadness, there's shame, there's anger, there's fear, and typically there's some kind of desire for somebody or a strong feeling of love for someone. And those things are all happening in some complex combination at the same time. And while all that's happening, we're giving a lot of meaning to it all. We're applying a bunch of beliefs and ideas about it. And so there's this complex configuration of feelings and meanings that we call jealousy. And if you stop calling it jealousy, at least temporarily, to pay attention to what's really going on, then you start to notice there are things going on that you can work with to allow movement in a feeling that otherwise tends to get kind of stuck in us. We get stuck in jealousy. We can't figure out how to get any wiggle room, any slack.
Well, not only that, but then we think, oh, well, I shouldn't have to be jealous. You're making me jealous, and I need to change your behavior so that I don't get jealous.
Oh, this sounds kind of familiar.
This is right? Like, this is about arguments again.
Right. This is definitely an argument. Okay. So if we were now applying this notion of what happens if we collaborate, what happens if we make it our jobs to see that the other person gets their needs met, right? Then you're telling me about how jealous you are. What I want to say to you is, okay, I want to help you to feel more safe and secure in our relationship. I want you to know unshakably about how much I love you. I want you to have a sense that this will never go away. I want you to feel really good about our connection and totally, thoroughly loved by me. And then your job is, I don't know what it is that we're arguing about exactly. You're saying I'm making you jealous. Your job is maybe to say, well, I want you to have a really good relationship with your ex and get to spend time together and enjoy each other. And I want you to get to feel love for as many people as you love, because that's clearly something that matters to you. And then we're faced with this complex problem of how do we both get that? And it really is possible. It really is possible, but you have to have some facility with dealing with some complex experiences like jealousy. How do you deconstruct that experience to see what's going on under the hood and then learn how to make some changes to it. Changes to the structure of meaning that gives you jealousy, the kinds of insecurity that you have learned to take on about yourself, the notions of scarcity about getting what you need, the ways that we build a kind of codependency into thinking about relationships and aloneness. Right, those things all have to be deconstructed in order for us to be able to collaborate together on creating a relationship where you feel secure and I feel free.
And I think what you said about really looking at your emotions, they're actually, you don't feel jealous, you feel angry, or you maybe you're afraid that the other person is going to leave you. I think it's really important to own your feelings, like not saying, not blaming them on the other person, like you make me feel whatever, you make me feel jealous, but saying I feel angry, I feel sad, it, you know, and not saying, you know, you have to make me not feel that way, it's your responsibility to make me feel something different, but instead just to be with that feeling. Because, you know, all of our feelings come from our, you know, unconscious mind. And our unconscious mind has a lot of information about the world. And we make most of our decisions in our unconscious mind first, and then they burble up to our rational mind just to get logically analyzed and justified. Like they do some brain scans about how we make our decisions, and there's brain activity in the unconscious mind first. So we make the decision in the unconscious mind and then send it up to the conscious mind to be rationalized. So it's really important to be like, what really do I feel? And, you know, don't worry about it. Like, if you feel angry, if you feel sad, if you feel afraid, you know, like, that's a normal human emotion and you have reasons to feel that way. But don't make it a reason to try to control the other person's behavior, because that's not going to make them feel loved.
In this imagined dynamic between the two of us now, where, you know, you're trying to control my behavior, what I want to say to you instead is that I recognize that you're struggling with something, that you're feeling some feelings that are really challenging for you, and you're asking for my help with them. You may superficially seem to be asking me to change my behavior, but what I think you're really doing is you're saying, these feelings are really terrible. I can't tolerate them, and I certainly can't tolerate them alone. Can you give me a hand? And then it becomes my job to figure out, how do I give you love in the places where you are feeling pain, and maybe where you're feeling pain around the meanings that you're assigning to the things that I'm doing.
Right. So instead of making you not ever have lunch with your ex again, you can instead make me feel like you're not going to leave me, or that you love me in special and unique ways that you never felt about your ex, or, you know, whatever it is that's unique to our actual relationship. And then you can find all the wonderful, juicy things about what's happening between us right now and give each other more of that to, like, make up for any sense, like, I'm afraid, you know, I'm sad, you know, I'm angry.
Yeah, and but there's a step that you don't want to skip. So what you're talking about is, you know, I could provide reassurance and a reality check sometimes to help you remember what's true about our relationship that will maybe help you to feel more secure in it. But there's this other dimension where you're feeling some painful emotion and I don't want to shut it down. My goal is not to reassure you so you don't have to feel it. My goal is rather to figure out how to give you a chance to fully feel it. Because if you're afraid of losing me, there's some ancient fear of loss in you from probably real loss that happens of one sort or another. And there's some part of you that's trying to heal that. And like you said, you know, relationships become this kind of advanced training ground for becoming human beings, the people that we want to be. And so here it is right now. You've got this tremendous fear of loss, this deep sadness and grief in you, and it's coming up in the moment in our relationship, and I want to be able to help you with it. This is why I put so much work in training people to be counselors and coaches. It's not so much because I'm concerned with having lots of people who are professional counselors and coaches in the world, but it's because the skills that people develop as counselors are exactly these skills. How do I help someone heal an old emotional hurt that's in the way of their having the life or the relationship they want in the present? How do I help them develop capacities that they don't have so that they're able to be with things that they otherwise couldn't be with? How do I get them free of their old conditioning so that they can be more their true selves? Those are all skills that you learn when you learn to counsel somebody. And there are skills that I wish for everybody to be able to have, because relationships are so much more as possible in relationships when you can provide those things for each other, when you can really be each other's allies in healing and growth and liberation.
All good things. Healing, growth, liberation. So you can find out more about his counseling institute, the Interchange Counseling Institute, at interchangecounseling.com. And he teaches all these different classes, the power of goodbye. We talked about how to lose an argument, how to lose an argument, ending jealousy and ending jealousy forever. Also, he has a class called Healing Body Shame, and that's actually happening this weekend, so you may not be able to attend it. However, you can watch a great video about it. It's called Occupy Your Body. And did you actually film that in Golden Gate Park? Where did you film that?
Yeah, that's filmed at one of my favorite climbing trees just behind the Conservatory of Flowers, far from here.
Mm-hmm. And do you want to tell people about the book that you're thinking of writing just to say it?
Well, you're talking about my book on urban wilderness adventuring in San Francisco. Yeah, that'll be a couple
in
years,
future.
Probably in the works.
That's
but,
fine.
But yeah, when I'm not busy counseling and hacking relationships, I am tromping all over all the secret places in San Francisco trying to find interesting ways to traverse the urban wilderness.
Well, because we live in a city and we have bodies and it's so important to move our bodies and connect with nature, it's really important to like connect and appreciate the nature that the beautiful city of San Francisco has conserved for us, you know, and really appreciate it so that good things happen to it. Like, you know, instead of covering it with parking lots and condos, we actually have ducks and lakes and snowy egrets and waterfalls.
Yeah, we live in a really amazing place, and we have these perfect, beautiful bodies, and we have these endless opportunities for contact with one another. I mean, it's amazing that life is this good.
So we should enjoy it. Exactly. You can find out more about Steve Behrman and watch that video. It's really charming. It's called Occupy Your Body. And it kind of is almost a revolution. As much as it's so important, you know, getting in front of your computer and connecting with the world in that way, we really have to connect with ourselves and be in the moment. And it's amazing how it can make your sex life better. I'm just saying. So thank you so much for listening to Sexploration with Monica. Steve Behrman, thank you so much for coming on the show this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Monica.
It's Interchange Counseling Institute. That's interchangecounseling.com. This is Sexploration with Monica, broadcasting live from the waterfall in Golden Gate Park.
You can subscribe to Sexploration with Monica on iTunes and have new episodes delivered automatically. Or download free podcasts at sexplorationwithmonica.com.